Good evening, everyone. You are listening to Moss Radio. This is Moss Reading Hour with Stone. And we are reading Leanne Batasimasak Simpson's book, Theory of Water, Anishinaabe Maps to the Times Ahead. And I started to read the first, I think it was the first two chapters of this book a few weeks ago, during a broadcast where I shared back about a discussion and book talk that I went to with Batasimasak. And I have enjoyed reading her book, and I enjoyed going to that talk so much that I felt like other people would too. So, once again, this is Theory of Water, Anishinaabe Maps to the Times Ahead. And we're continuing on chapter 3, which is only 9 pages in. So I'm debating, you know, just starting over. But I guess if you would like us to start the book over, drop a comment, email us, DM us. But because I've already read the first two chapters on a broadcast a couple weeks ago, we're going to continue. So this is chapter 3, Listening to Our Present Moment. I do not have day. This is a quote in the beginning of the chapter. I do not have day, and I do not have moonlight. I do not believe in time. I do believe in water. In 1991, Rebecca Belmore made a 6x7 feet wide wooden megaphone in response to the so-called Oka Crisis, a Kanyan Kehaka uprising to defend their sacred pines and a burial ground from becoming an 18-hole golf course. Belmore wanted people to address the land directly, much as our ancestors had, and to experience, quote, political protest as poetic action. The sound installation and mixed media sculpture is large. It is made of plywood, cork, cork inlay, mahogany veneer, varnish, fiberglass, leather, and ochre, and embedded with a loud hailer. It looks like a very large version of a birch bark moose collar used by hunters to call in moose. Over the next few years, she traveled with the piece, setting it up on reserves, shorelines, sacred places, and sites of resistance. Along the way, she often slept beside it in her van. In Anishinaabemowin, the piece was called Ayumi Awach, Umama Moan, translated into English as speaking to their mother. And as Belmore traveled, the piece became an instrument invoking a gathering space for indigenous people to amplify our voices and speak directly to the land. Our old people, Belmore's and mine, had and have an intimate relationship with the land and the water. They spoke to the sun in the mornings and the moon at night as cherished relatives. They visited with the water lilies and Labrador tea before they picked these plants to make medicine. They prayed to the ones that had passed on to the spirit world, and they prayed to the spiritual beings that lived in their worlds. They spoke with and dreamed of beavers and muskrats before they harvested them. They made offerings to the whitefish before setting nets, and to the lakes and rivers for safe passage. They were in constant dialogue with the living things that made up their world, which is saying something, because Anishinaabe are not known as chatty people. Many Anishinaabe still do this today while harvesting, making medicines, or in ceremony. For many of us, the sound waves of our voices, vibrations made from the instrument of the body, are an affecting force in the universe. It is within this context that I understand Ayumi Awach Umama Moan. At first, Belmore installed the piece on the land, outside galleries, outside the confines of the so-called white box, and into the network of living things that contains the potentiality of indigenous peoples. In this way, the performance installation became a gathering site, a communal meaning-making project, and a space that generates knowledge. Ayumi Yawa Chumama Mowan placed bodies in relation to land and water and asked us to engage through sound and listening. In a conversation with Anishinaabe curator Wanda Nanabush in 2014, Belmore said that her strategy of bringing a conceptual artwork in the form of a functional tool to the people and asking them to speak directly to the land itself, as we have always done, strengthened her understanding of the role of the artist. The artist, the maker, the visionary, has always been part of who we are. Looking back now at the photographs and the videos from their first journeys of Ayumi Yawa Chumama Mowan, I get a strong sense of how the piece brought people together. At Fort William First Nation, where the art was facing Lake Superior, and at the Wiggins Bay blockade in northern Saskatchewan, the piece is surrounded by friends, families, children, and elders. There are fires burning and people visiting. There is the sharing of food and stories and people taking turns speaking through the megaphone. People are embracing the piece, speaking their hearts and minds, their bodies and voices becoming the piece too, becoming part of the multiple meanings it generated. There are only a few records of what Indigenous people said into the megaphone. In retrospect, this is a lovely part of the work and only possible because Ayumi Yawa Chumama Mowan was born in the 1990s, when we didn't yet record everything on our phones. The thousands of conversations that took place were private and remained between the speakers, those gathered in that spot at the time, and the universe. Rehearsed and unrehearsed, in English, in Anishinaabemowin, in song and prayer, the things that were said and the things that were unsaid, the demonic accounting of lives, a collective accounting of a present moment. The point of the piece was not just the content of the speeches or even the megaphone itself as a piece of conceptual art. Rather, meaning was made through speaking and listening, and through traveling the land, bringing people together to engage in the practice of speaking and listening to non-human forms of life on reserves, in towns and cities, and at sites of Indigenous land reclamation. When I think of that piece today, I think of the iconic photo showing it upon our sacred Animki Waji, in the care of Fort William First Nation in Thunder Bay, Ontario. It was installed facing Lake Superior, below where Animikig, or Thunderbirds, nest. I imagine what it would have been like to be there that day. The laughing, the joy, the sense of being present. In contrast, I remember my kids being frightened of their own voices at Ayumi Yawa Chumama Mowan. As Ayumi Yawa Chumama Mowan amplified them in the scary white box gallery of the National Gallery in Ottawa, pointing out how out of place it was there. I think too of the birch bark moose cone collars our hunters use in the fall, which is perhaps the form that this piece enlarges, and the circumstances that compelled Belmore to build a megaphone so that our ancestors and our relatives could hear our voices over the noise of capitalism. Noise that has only become louder and more total since the piece was created in the 1990s. Belmore remembers the first installation of Ayumi Yawa Chumama Mowan in the mountains of Banff National Park. Inside the megaphone shape, she had placed a battery-operated hailer that amplified the voice of any speaker talking into the sculpture. She talks about how the sound would build and go out into the landscape and onto the land and find an echo. In Banff, this was acoustically amazing, as the speaker's voice would echo 9, 10, 11 times. Belmore says that the point of this piece was to look at the idea of indigenous protest and to aim participants' voices not at the government, the prime minister, or the army, but at the land itself. The idea was that the land has been hearing the sound of us for a very, very long time. The echo asks the speaker to be confronted with their own self-reflection between the land and themselves. I think of our ancestors who spoke to their ancestors through the sound of rushing water. It's one of the many reasons that hydro dams, interpretive centers, and lift locks are so irritating to us. They close off channels of communication. The sound of rushing water is a kind of portal to another world. Places where waves of energy altered human hearing were often where spiritual beings lived or where certain significant events happened. And the sounds in these places, such as that of moving water, were normalized. The idea that Belmore would have to stop us and amplify the sounds so we could hear them would be startling to these ancestors. While the relevance of Ayumiyawa Chumamamoan still resonates today, the work also gave birth to siblings in 2017 in a series called Wave Sound. Revisiting and inverting the concept of the megaphone, Belmore made four sculptures, varying in shape and form, to amplify the sound of water and shoreline. The sculptures were installed in Banff National Park, Alberta, Gros Morne National Park in Newfoundland, in Anishinaabe Territory in Pukaskwa National Park in Ontario, and on reserve in Chimnising Island in Georgian Bay, which is part of the Beausoleil First Nation in Ontario. Three of the 170-pound conical listening devices were made of aluminum casts, an aesthetic echo of who the listeners were likely to be in the locations where these three were installed. Non-Indigenous peoples. For the sculpture on reserve land, Belmore used copper, a material that echoes Anishinaabe history, story, and material use. Copper is said to be the blood of two groups of Manadoug, or spirits, Animikig, Thunderbirds, and Mishibizig, the underwater panthers, who engaged in an epic battle in the Great Lakes region, spilling their blood on shorelines and rocky outcrops. Copper offers itself to the Anishinaabe by making itself visible on the ground. It is used to hold water in our ceremonies and represent spaces in between the sky, waters, and land. To make the sculptures, Belmore cast the rock in each site-specific location, rock that was created out of thousands of years of wind, rain, snow, and ice, and then wrapped the castings around conical frames. The forms were helicoptered into the sites so that visitors would happen upon them while hiking. These were large-scale temporary installations camouflaged in their surrounds, amplifying the unique sounds of each place. Instead of inviting us to speak, Wave Sound asks us to practice embodied listening, a deep listening and feeling using one's entire being. Wave Sound is an invitation to gather at the shore, sit down, and use our bodies to hear wind, rock, sand, maybe even mosquitoes in the durational rhythm of waves. Iris Blake writes that Wave Sound gestures towards listening and disability, with the conical devices functioning as hearing aids. I think that it suggests how settlers under colonialism have never ever been able to hear the expansive web of living things that we refer to as land, just as they have never heard Indigenous peoples. When I encounter it, even in a gallery setting, I don't look at sound wave, although I could for a long time, because it is aesthetically stunning. Instead, I become enmeshed in wave sound, placing my body on the land to quiet it and to listen beside Nibi, to listen through Nibi, to listen with Nibi. Interrupting myself for a second. For those of you that are just listening for the first time, Nibi is the word for water in Anishinaabewan. Instead, I become enmeshed in wave sound, placing my body on the land to quiet it and to listen beside Nibi, to listen through Nibi, to listen with Nibi, a being that changes form from liquid to solid to gas, that travels the sky world, the underground, and inside and outside my body, an ancient formation of molecules that has been the same since the beginning of this world, a fugitive that erodes and escapes containment, and one that we simply cannot live without. I quiet, I listen. Through these rehearsals, wave sound for me amplifies the voices of water to cut through the noise of colonialism. It works in concert with my great-grandparents praying and carrying water, and with those yet to be born to become a practice. Together with my cochlea and auditory nerve, my mind and my heart, wave sound transforms the instrument to belonging as Nibi. Wave sound transforms from instrument to belonging as Nibi. Belmore and all the life she has gathered work alongside me to generate meaning and inspire new worlds. And so I take Belmore's invitation seriously. After 3 years of pandemic, amplified fascism, freedom convoys, dying glaciers, misdiagnoses, police killings, children alone in cages at borders, open-air prisons for entire peoples, all in the name of racial capitalism, I'm asking myself, what does it mean to listen to water? What does it mean to believe in water? Another interruption. Well, I'll just reintroduce what we're reading in case you're just tuning in or didn't catch the beginning of the broadcast. This is Leanne Batasamasok Simpson's book, Theory of Water, Anishinaabe Maps to the Times Ahead. Leanne Batasamasok Simpson is a writer, a storyteller, musician, and she's Anishinaabe, if you haven't picked up on that, which is an indigenous territory in the Great Lakes region. And this book came out in 2025 for context. Chapter 4, Centering. Jackson Creek is down the street from where I live in Peterborough, Ontario. It flows into the man-made Little Lake, then into Otonabee River, and eventually into Lake Ontario. There is a 4.5-kilometer trail alongside the creek where I run in spring, summer, fall, and parts of the winter when I can't skate ski on it. Jackson Creek is, by most accounts, an unremarkable urban creek. I imagine much like every other urban creek in North America, and it is the body of water I spend the most time with every day. Peterborough is built on top of Jackson Creek, a fact that became evident to most residents in 2004 after more than 150 millimeters of rain fell in less than 2 hours, and the creek burst its banks and flooded the city's downtown. These were the real and poetic consequences of constraining the creek to make room for urban development, forcing it into smaller and smaller underground tunnels unable to carry stormwater. Tunnels that instead furiously expelled it without regard for homes, cars, or city infrastructure. Doug Williams, my elder and friend who passed away in July 2022, used to talk about the creek and its portage as part of the Michisagig-Nishnabeg route that connected Ngojiwanong, the place at the foot of the rapids, or Peterborough, with Chemung Lake. Every time I'm on the trail, I think of Doug and I think of that passageway. One day recently, the creek was beginning to freeze after the first big storm of the winter brought us nearly 30 centimeters of snow. I was up early on the snowmobile doing passes along the river, compacting the heavy, wet snow so that tomorrow another driver could attach the groomer. I had started helping groom the trail a year earlier during one of the pandemic winters. I volunteered at first just to keep up my snowmobile skills when I was in the south so that when I returned to work in the north, I didn't have to relearn how to drive the sled every time. Grooming the trail certainly helped with that. But soon those technical skills were eclipsed by something else entirely. As a lifelong skier and lover of the winter, I thought I knew a lot about snow. When I was a competitive skier, I spent a lot of time figuring out wax by measuring snow temperature and paying attention to how much water the snow was carrying, how fresh it was, and how packed the trail. This is a crucial part of ski racing, and it is why Olympic Nordic teams have waxing coaches and teams of people monitoring the snow. Races are won and lost on waxing. I thought I knew something about it, and I was wrong. I discovered that nearly every day the snow was slightly different along the trail at Jackson Creek. I became fascinated by sintering. When a snowflake falls from the sky and lands on Earth, it immediately begins, or perhaps continues, a transformation as it forms bonds at temperatures below zero. This is not a melting process. Sorry, that was in parentheses. I read that weirdly. A transformation that it forms as it forms bonds at temperatures below zero. This is not a melting process with its neighboring snowflakes or crystals to create the fabric of a snowpack. Sintering is a joining. It is a communal transformation that creates a fabric of former snowflakes bonded to each other. It is a process of changing from a singular angular snowflake to a more rounded form of bonded crystals or a snowpack, a denser, more compact linked formation. As the snow sinters, it settles and becomes denser, stronger, and soggier under the influence of gravity. Sintering is slow deformation. Groomers pay attention to sintering because there is nothing like skating along a well-groomed trail of packed snow. It feels like flying. Many factors influence sintering: temperature, humidity, time of day, weather, who is using the trail, and how. But I think of none of those each morning when I'm on the sled. I think only of this idea, that the first thing a snowflake does when it lands on from the sky world is to join bonds, actual physical bonds, with its neighbors. It weaves itself into its environment, and it does so in a way that doesn't destroy its neighbors. Sintering is bonding. It is building coalitions with your neighbors. And these coalitions mean that the packed sinter snow on the trail has staying power, that it remains long after spring has melted the snow around it. I want to read that again because I think those few lines are so important in this chapter. The first thing a snowflake does when it lands from the sky world is to join bonds, actual physical bonds, with its neighbors. It weaves itself into its environment, and it does so in a way that doesn't destroy its neighbors. Sintering is bonding. It is building coalitions with your neighbors. And these coalitions mean that the packed sinter snow on the trail has staying power, that it remains long after spring has melted the snow around it. Snowflakes are extraordinary. I understand from snow scientists that they start out as a single nucleated dust particle that attracts water droplets, and that these in turn freeze and accrete into a crystal form. The temperature and humidity in the sky world mold the snowflake into complex shapes as it moves through the atmosphere. No two are the same, as they act in mass and in communion to form magnificent storms, upheavals, and blankets. When I signed up to be a groomer, I was expecting to learn practical things: how to start a tired, aging, cold snowmobile, the correct speed for dragging the groomer utensil over the trail so that it is perfectly packed, and how to back up and turn around while pulling something. I wasn't expecting the snow to teach me how to live in the world. But of course, this is why I love the land, and this is why I spend as much time as I do sintering with the lakes and rivers, cedars and maples, deer and geese. The snow is telling me that sintering is how Minchi Sagig Nishnabeg make worlds, how we weave ourselves into the land without destroying it. A snowstorm reminds me of what radical overturning and transformations can be accomplished when sintering creates deep attachments across many, many individuals. Sintering in the forest is easy for me. Sintering with people I'm currently sharing the planet with, much more difficult. These days, I ask myself if sintering could play a role in grounding my method of solidarity, in strengthening and renewing connections across communities of struggle towards new constellations of co-resistance. Could sintering be a foundational concept for creating such constellations? One early morning while I was grooming the trail, I was thinking about centering and listening to a podcast called Conjuncture. The episode Against Pessimism featured Robin D.G. Kelly, and in it, Robin spoke with Jordan T. Camp about a variety of topics coalescing around our present moment. Robin spoke about this moment that we all share, telling us that liberalism and fascism share the same goals to shore up capitalism, maintain class and surplus, and keep the markets afloat. Sometimes, he said, fascism works better. At other times, liberalism. Fascism makes liberalism possible. I thought of Justin Trudeau wearing his reconciliation socks, embodying the idea that he is Indigenous people's best friend, with his tattoo, the smudging, the big drum and blanket, the headdress. Meanwhile, he has whittled colonialism down to residential school abuses. He has paid the money and facilitated the Pope. I imagine Trudeau's team organizing Instagram posts of hide tanning and powwow dancing, logging them into their database and constructing a brand of indigeneity that is a good sell to liberal whites and liberal Indigenous peoples alike. This anti-racist multicultural fuel is what financial capital thrives on, as Kelly said to Camp. In another part of the podcast, Robin talked about Gramsci and his 1924 work Against Pessimism. I'm trying to remember all of it, he said, although to me it seemed his mind held an astounding catalog of details. He talked about how Gramsci pushed back against Communist International and the historic moment when Italian communists facing Mussolini's fascist rise declared, quote, "We have to withdraw." According to Gramsci, this was pessimism defined by fatalism, the idea that the crisis was coming, the economy was about to collapse, and the communists would just have to wait it out. Gramsci said, no, we need to act now. We can't wait. We need worker rebellions like the ones that occurred in Turin. Listening to this, I wrote down, quote, "This is where we are. We don't need to be defensive about anti-fascism, but active, engaged, and on the offensive," end quote. And, quote, "Masses of people in rebellion create crisis," end quote. I thought about the past few years, our recent history that showed the precarity of life, and also the calculations about who was worthy of living and who was assigned to perish. I thought of the never-ending crises and how it was easy, very easy, for some of us to be disengaged, to just wait it out. I thought about what was happening that very day, which was the day after the COP15 struck its historic deal to sacrifice 70% of the planet, the day the world waited for the January 6th panel to announce what we already knew, the day the Dutch Prime Minister performed an apology for the Netherlands' historic role in the slave trade. I thought about the ongoing genocides in Gaza, the Sudan, Congo. And here I was listening to a thinker I deeply respected who compelled me, demanded even, to be active and on the offensive. Who demanded that I fight, that we fight together. Kelly talked about Cedric Robinson's work as Black anti-fascism, and I thought about what Indigenous anti-fascism might look like, and Anishinaabeg anti-fascism, Michisagig Anishinaabeg anti-fascism. That is, I wondered, what it would look like to have a critique of fascism from within the formation of thought and perhaps a specific school of thought of the Michisagig Anishinaabeg. What would it mean to have the sort of structuring and organizing that occurs outside what we usually imagine when we think of movements and anti-fascist writers and scholarship on these issues? What would it look like to have a school of thought that is largely embodied, that is oral, and that has been under attack since contact? A school of thought that is still difficult to propose, argue, and justify within the academy because it refuses the academy as an ethic, even as the academy cannot reproduce the sort of people who embody this sort of thinking. A kind of theory that is generated through continual practice, that is in constant motion. As if I was sitting beside him, perhaps visiting with him at the shore of a lake, I listened to Kelly tell Camp that Robinson's work in Black Marxism isn't really about racial capitalism. It is truly about Black revolt. Robinson, he said, traces the source of the ideologies of enslaved Black people to the beliefs, moralities, cosmologies, metaphysics, and intellectual traditions of the superstructures they were violently stripped from, not from the modes of production they were forced to labor within. In this, I heard ways of thinking, epistemologies, ways of knowing, practices, and ethics from Indigenous peoples on the African continent. Kelly traced this influence forward in the Black radical tradition through the writings of Du Bois, C.L.R. James, and Richard Wright, a theory of Black radicalism that developed through what they found in the movements of Black masses. Listening to this podcast while grooming the trail led me to a moment of revelation. I have for a long time felt an affinity toward the Black feminists and the Black radical tradition, but also worried that this affinity was a kind of mining for knowledge and practice that I couldn't find in my own community. I stick on the words, couldn't find in my own community, as I write them down, because I know with certainty now that this is simply not true. There is an uncompromising, incommensurable critique of colonialism and capitalism from within Anishinaabeg thought, and it has not only formed the foundation, and it not only formed the foundation of resistance for my ancestors, it is the catalyst for my own resistance. My ancestors, through embodied practice, physical and spiritual, and through our shared culture, although I cringe when I type that word because culture cannot stand in for all thought, theory, and practice, resisted, critiqued, and mobilized against capitalism from the time of contact with Europeans. Our fight is our critique, and as Robinson teaches us, rebellion is an embodied critique that can lead to intellectual traditions. In the case Robinson refers to, the Black radical tradition. Rebellion is an embodied critique. Just reading that again. Indigenous peoples mobilized and lived otherwise because they had material and ethical imperatives to do so. And this ethical imperative came from the land and the waters, from their intimate relationship to these. Perhaps this tradition helped produce the kind of thinking that Rebecca Belmore did with water, and the thinking I'm now doing with snow. My ancestors' critique of capitalism was embodied in a coalition of practices, and it's only in facing the loss of those practices that attempting to write down this critique makes sense. My ancestors made lives that fit seamlessly into the complicated networks across scales that make up the planetary living system. These networks at once fit into the global water cycle, recognize the work of the sun and the moon in the design on the turtle's back, and reenact the same ethos of networks through interactions with children and family members from within this frame. Capitalism, which presents as greed, must have been immediately recognizable and appalling to whoever was on the shoreline when the first explorers stepped off the boat in the name of whatever monarchy was demanding empire and loyalty. My ancestors were very good at centering. In other words, at living in a way that bonded them to the different forms of life with whom they were sharing time and space. They were building not a Anishinaabeg world, but a Anishinaabeg coalition, working with plant life, animal life, and all other planetary forces that existed before humans. They centered and wove themselves into the existing fabric of life, working in concert with the planet to renew themselves. Centering is fractal-like, expanding and contracting across scales. It is nonlinear, iterative, transformative, and adaptive. Centering creates possibility. It is reflected in indigenous practices of politics, economy, and governance. And it is crucial collective work in creating constellations of co-resistance. I want to read those last two paragraphs of this chapter again. My ancestors were very good at centering. In other words, at living in a way that bonded them to the different forms of life with whom they were sharing time and space. They were building not a Anishinaabeg world, but a Anishinaabeg coalition, working with plant life, animal life, and all the other planetary forces that existed before humans. They centered and wove themselves into the existing fabric of life, working in concert with the planet to renew themselves. Centering is fractal-like, expanding and contrasting across scales. It is nonlinear, iterative, transformative, and adaptive. Centering creates possibility. It is reflected in indigenous practices of politics, economy, and governance, and it is crucial collective work in creating constellations of co-resistance. That was chapter 4 of Theory of Water by Leanne Batasimasok Simpson. That chapter was called Centering. And although we're not out of time yet, I don't think I have time to read the next chapter. So I'll close out tonight's broadcast a little early, but I want to leave listeners with this idea of centering and how snowflakes, as soon as they leave the sky world and come down to Earth, they form bonds with one another to create stronger snowpacks. And what Batasimasok was getting at in this chapter was explaining centering, but how she's listening to and learning from that snow process and using that as a framework to look out on the world and conceive of building these coalitions of co-resistance, as she said at the end of the chapter. So, and she said that in the centering process, these snowflakes bond with one another to create something new without destroying their neighbors. And she brought that up in her talk at the event I went to a couple weeks ago. And I haven't stopped thinking about it. And I hope that you don't stop thinking about it either. How can we build without destroying our neighbors and destroying one another? And I don't just mean your human neighbors, but all life that you get to live around or that lives around you. So I guess go into the rest of your week thinking about bonds and connections and different relationships that you can build that aren't destructive. And yeah, I'll leave it at that. Thank you for listening to Moss Radio Reading Hour. This will continue on Sundays moving forward, but not this next Sunday. So just pay attention to the weekly schedule that gets posted. If you enjoyed this, please come back for more. We'll hopefully get through two chapters per broadcast. because I'm not very good at reading out loud, so I don't think I can do it longer than that. But yeah, thank you for listening. Have a good night.